So imagine you wake up. It's a bright, sunny morning.
Oh, the best kind of day.
Right. You step outside. The sky is perfectly clear. The pressure is high. According to all the standard weather models, it's going to be a beautiful, totally benign day.
But then it completely flips.
Exactly. By nightfall, a town just maybe a few miles away could be completely underwater. And today, we are looking at why the deadliest flash floods often start on the clearest days, and why relying on those traditional daily forecasting tools can just completely blindside us.
Yeah, that false sense of security, it's the absolute definition of what forecasters call diagnostic muddy waters.
Diagnostic muddy waters, I like that.
Right, because you can't just look at a satellite image or some computer model at dawn and see this glowing red dot that says, a flash flood will happen exactly here at 4 p.m.
It's just not that simple.
No, I mean, the atmosphere simply does not broadcast intentions that neatly.
Which is really the core reason we're doing this deep dive today. We're looking at a foundational white paper from the National Severe Storms Laboratory. It's titled Flash Flood Forecasting, an ingredients-based methodology written by Doswell, Brooks, and Maddox.
A classic.
A total classic. And our mission today is to take you behind the curtain of the meteorological forecasting desk. We aren't going to just, talk about abstract computer models or black box statistical algorithms.
Right, we're keeping it grounded.
Grounded. We are going to decode the exact physical ingredients that combine to create a flash flood. So you can really understand how forecasters actually think in real time.
Okay, let's unpack this. Where do we even begin with a system as chaotic as the sky?
Well, we begin by just stripping away all of that computational complexity.
Okay.
The real beauty of this paper is how it discards those overly complex algorithms in favor of a timeless physical understanding of the atmosphere.
Right.
And it actually starts with a concept from a meteorologist named C.F. Chappell. And the authors describe this concept as almost absurdly simple. I have to say, I always appreciate finding the phrase absurdly simple in a dense scientific paper. It feels like a lifeline, honestly.
Oh, it really is. And the core concept is literally just this: the heaviest precipitation occurs where the rainfall rate is the highest for the longest time.
Wow, okay. That is simple. And mathematically, they express it as an equation, right?
They do.
So it's precipitation, or P, equals the average rainfall rate, which is R, multiplied by duration, or D. So P equals R times D.
Exactly.
I think probably the most intuitive way to visualize this for anyone listening is to imagine filling a bucket with a garden hose.
Oh, that's a perfect analogy.
Right. So the total amount of water you get in that bucket, which is the precipitation, it depends entirely on two physical actions.
Right.
First, how far you open the nozzle, which determines the rate.
Yeah.
And second, how long you stand there holding it over the bucket, which is the duration.
That garden hose analogy perfectly captures the mechanics at play here. And, if we look at historical real-world floods, this equation clearly separates different types of disasters.
Like river floods versus flash floods.
Exactly. Think about massive river floods like the infamous Mississippi and Missouri River floods of 1993.
Oh, yeah, those were devastating.
Right, but those build up over weeks and weeks. So the atmospheric nozzle might not be cranked open all the way to the maximum, but the duration is just
So
immense.
someone is essentially holding that hose over the river basin for an entire month.
You got it. But flash floods, on the other hand, they require moderately high to extremely high rates. We are talking roughly 25 millimeters or about an inch of rain per hour.
An inch an hour.
Yeah, combined with moderately long durations, like an hour or more.
Wow. I mean, an inch an hour is an aggressive amount of water for any municipal drainage system to handle.
It is an incredible volume, but I need to add a crucial warning here that the paper makes very clear.
Okay, what's the warning?
Looking for strict binary quantitative thresholds, like saying a flash flood will only happen if we hit exactly 1 inch per hour, it's an intellectual trap.
Oh, I see. Because it varies by location.
Exactly. What constitutes a dangerous threshold in one specific hydrometeorological situation might be totally manageable in another.
Right.
It is always the specific combination of the local factors that dictates the actual outcome.
Makes sense. I want to dig into the first half of that equation, though, the rate.
Okay, let's do it.
I'm picturing a massive summer storm, but surely it takes more than just, a lot of dark clouds to get these extreme hose level rainfall rates. What is actually happening inside the cloud to force that much water out?
Well, to get a truly high rainfall rate, you actually need three variables to sync up perfectly.
Three variables.
You need lift, moisture, and precipitation efficiency.
Got it. Lift, moisture, and efficiency.
Right. So in the physics outlined in the paper, the rainfall rate is proportional to something called vertical moisture flux.
Vertical moisture flux.
Basically, you need a rapid, violent ascent of air. That's your lift. And that rising air must contain a substantial amount of water vapor, which is your moisture.
So warm, wet air getting violently shoved upward into the colder layers of the atmosphere.
Correct. And when it goes up, it cools rapidly, the moisture condenses, and then gravity pulls it down as rain.
Right.
But the third variable is the real catch here, precipitation efficiency.
Yeah, I have to say, I found this part a bit counterintuitive when I was reading. I mean, doesn't all the water that goes up into a cloud eventually come down as rain?
Right.
Why is efficiency a limiting factor at all?
It's a huge piece of the puzzle because clouds are remarkably leaky
Oh,
systems.
leaky.
Very leaky. I mean, virtually 99% of the water vapor drawn into a thunderstorm does condense into liquid simply because the storm pop is so incredibly cold.
Okay, so it does condense.
It condenses, yes, but condensing into a cloud droplet is a long way from actually hitting the ground as a raindrop. A massive amount of that condensed water just evaporates midair before it ever reaches the
Oh,
surface,
wow.
or it gets swept away by high altitude winds and evaporates miles downwind.
So the storm is essentially just bleeding water throughout its entire life cycle.
Precisely. Efficiency drops dramatically if the surrounding environmental air is dry, meaning low relative humidity.
Right.
It also drops if the storm is isolated. An isolated storm pulls in dry air from the surrounding environment, a process known as entrainment.
Entrainment. Okay.
Yeah, that dry air literally mixes into the cloud, aggressively evaporating the droplets.
Ah, I see.
That's why a storm embedded inside a larger cloud system is much more efficient. Its immediate environment is already saturated, so it doesn't lose its water to evaporation.
That makes total sense as to why deep, moist convection, what we generally refer to as heavy summer thunderstorms, why they are usually the culprit for flash floods.
Absolutely.
Because they possess that massive, buoyant instability, they create these violent updrafts that process huge amounts of moisture. And because they often form in highly humid environments, their efficiency remains incredibly high.
They do, but what's fascinating here is that the most visually terrifying storms aren't necessarily the most efficient rainmakers.
Wait, really?
Yeah, take supercell thunderstorms, those massive rotating beasts that produce tornado.
Right, the ones that look like the end of the world.
Exactly. You would intuitively think they'd be the ultimate flash flood producers, but they often have remarkably low precipitation efficiency.
Really? Because the mechanics that make them so violent actually work against their ability to drop rain straight down.
You nailed it. Their intense winds and massive updrafts can actually sweep the precipitation away from the core, and they interact violently with environmental wind shear.
So the wind just blows the water away before it can fall?
Pretty much. All that chaotic wind leads to massive evaporation. Now, there is a distinct subcategory called high precipitation or HP supercells, which overcome this and definitely can cause massive floods.
Okay.
But broadly speaking, a standard tornado-producing supercell is not an efficient rain machine.
Man, that changes your perspective completely. The storm tearing the roof off a barn might not be the one that floods the river valley.
Exactly right.
Okay, so we've established how a storm can dump an incredible volume of water. We've opened the nozzle.
The nozzle is open.
But a fast-moving storm just leaves a wet highway. What invisible forces conspire to trap that storm over a single town to satisfy the D in our equation, the duration?
Duration comes down to two primary dynamics: how massive the storm system is and its specific vector of movement.
So size and speed.
Size and direction, really. A huge system passing over you naturally takes longer to clear out than a small, isolated cell. But the direction of that movement is the critical variable.
Okay, how so?
Well, if you have a massive, long squall line of storms and it's moving perfectly perpendicular to its length, imagine a ruler sweeping vertically across a desk. It passes over any given geographic point pretty rapidly.
But if it moves parallel to its length, like just sliding along its own axis.
Then it takes a devastatingly long time to pass over a single point.
Right. And the paper introduces a concept here that I found incredibly helpful to visualize, the train effect or training convection.
A very classic term in meteorology.
Yeah. Imagine a train on a railroad track. Instead of one giant storm sitting absolutely still over your neighborhood, it's actually a constant moving assembly line of new, intense convective cells.
Yes.
Just passing over the exact same spot, one after another, like boxcars rolling down a track.
That distinction is vital for understanding extreme duration. And, you know, to understand why that invisible train track gets laid down over a specific town in the first place, we have to look at a complex meteorological reality.
Which is?
A convective storm system isn't a solid physical object.
Right. It isn't a book or a rock being pushed across the table.
Exactly. A storm is a continuous process. The movement of a storm system is actually the vector sum of two different actions.
Okay. What are the two actions?
First, you have simple wind advection, which is just the upper-level winds blowing the existing rain cells along. We call that cell motion.
Cell motion. Got it.
But the second part is propagation.
Propagation, meaning the atmospheric birth of brand new cells.
Yes, the continuous development of new convective cells. So if the ambient wind is blowing the existing cells to the east at 30 miles per hour, but new cells are violently forming on the western edge of the storm at 30 miles per hour,
then the math cancels out entirely.
Yes, exactly.
The wind pushes at 30 miles east, but it rebuilds 30 miles west, making the system as a whole appear to freeze in place over one unlucky area.
That cancellation effect is exactly what traps a storm. And the reason new cells keep forming in that exact same spot is usually tied to mesoscale boundaries.
Mesoscale boundaries.
Yeah. When we say mesoscale, we're really just talking about middle-sized weather features.
Right.
Bigger than a single cloud, but smaller than a massive continent-wide front.
The paper describes these boundaries almost like invisible atmospheric ramps.
That's a great way to view them, honestly. See, when an old thunderstorm rains out, it drops a massive pool of rain-cooled air beneath it.
Okay.
That's called an outflow boundary. Because cold air is physically denser and heavier than warm air, it spreads out along the ground like pancake batter.
Right. It's heavy.
So when the warm, moist environmental air flowing into the area hits that dense, cold pool, it hits it like a concrete ramp and is forced violently upward into the sky.
Oh, wow.
And if that cold pool boundary stalls and warm, wet air keeps slamming into it, new storm cells will continuously regenerate in that exact same location.
Which is exactly what happened during the catastrophic 1977 Johnstown, Pennsylvania flood. The paper highlights it as a classic example of this.
It is a textbook case, tragically.
An outflow boundary just stalled in place, the warm air kept hitting the ramp, and the storms just rebuilt over the exact same mountainous area for hours on end. It is the ultimate recipe for maximizing duration.
And that leads to a monumental challenge for the meteorologists actually working the forecasting desk.
Which brings me back to my earlier thought about that sunny morning. I'm wondering why forecasters can't just look at their computer models, check an index that flashes red, and issue a flash flood warning right then and there.
The authors emphatically warn against doing exactly that.
Really?
They explicitly state that over-reliance on computerized indices or literal pattern recognition, you know, just comparing today's radar to a textbook from 10 years ago, that can be fatal.
Because they completely miss the evolving threat.
They miss it because the ingredients for a flash flood are almost never in place in the morning.
Never.
Well, rarely. If they were, the flood would already be happening. A flash flood day often looks totally benign early on. In fact, one of the most surprising phenomena is that flash floods frequently happen near a 500 millibar high pressure ridge.
No, that is wild. I know a high-pressure ridge, especially at that 500 millibar mid-level of the atmosphere, usually brings highly stable, clear skies. So it's completely counterintuitive that this exact stability is acting like a lid on a pressure cooker.
That is the perfect analogy, a pressure cooker. The high pressure creates subsidence, which is gently sinking air. And that sinking air actively suppresses early small thunderstorms from forming. Because nothing is raining in the morning or early afternoon, massive amounts of atmospheric moisture and ground heat are allowed to secretly accumulate all day long without being consumed.
Wow.
The energy just hoards itself, building under that high-pressure lid until it finally breaks late in the day or overnight, erupting into a massive, slow-moving flood machine.
So what does this all mean? If the atmospheric models can't just hand you the answer early in the day, what is the forecaster actually supposed to analyze?
They have to realize that meteorology is only half the battle.
Only half.
Yeah. The authors state that a flash flood is the direct concatenation of a meteorological event with a highly specific hydrological situation.
Aye.
The ground beneath our feet dictates the outcome just as much as the sky above us.
The hidden hydrology. I have to say, I found this to be the most fascinating pivot in the paper.
It's so critical.
And it is perfectly illustrated by the Iowa case study from September 1989. Let me just lay this out.
Please do.
So an overnight mesoscale convective system, basically a massive organized cluster of thunderstorms, stalled right along one of those outflow boundaries we just discussed.
Right.
It dropped an incredible 180 millimeters of rain over a very small area. That is 7.2 inches of water.
A staggering amount.
The meteorological ingredients, the rate and the duration, were totally maxed out. But, and this is the crazy part, it only caused minor street flooding. No disaster, no catastrophic damage.
The meteorology was a 10 out of 10, but the hydrology completely absorbed the blow.
Literally absorbed it. Iowa had been suffering through 2 years of severe antecedent drought.
Yes.
The soil mechanics had completely changed. The water table was dramatically low, and the ground was incredibly dry and porous. So it acted like a giant thirsty sponge and pulled all 7.2 inches deep into the earth.
It's amazing.
If that soil had been saturated from previous weeks of rain, 7.2 inches of water stalling over one spot would have resulted in catastrophic runoff and a devastating disaster.
It proves that you cannot forecast a flood without knowing the intimate history of the dirt.
The history of the dirt, I love that.
And then, you know, there's the physical terrain itself. The paper briefly mentions a case from the Moapa Valley in Nevada from August 1981, just to highlight how mountainous topography is uniquely susceptible to these ingredients.
Right. Because mountains act as permanent physical ramps for that warm, moist air, much like those invisible cold pool boundaries do.
Exactly.
Plus, the specific geology of somewhere like Nevada, rocky, low absorption soil combined with steep, V-shaped canyons, it creates a violent funneling effect.
It really does.
It channels all that water from a massive catchment area into a single, highly destructive focal point. So even if forecasters can't pinpoint the exact street that will flood, they can identify the general threat area by layering the topography with the moisture flow.
Which perfectly sets up the final and perhaps most surprising case study in the deep dive today.
Yes.
Because up until now, we've been entirely focused on summer thunderstorms and convective energy. But the core ingredients equation, precipitation equals rate times duration, it doesn't strictly require thunder to function.
Here's where it gets really interesting. This is where the paper completely breaks the mold. You can have a massive historic flash flood without a single thunderstorm.
You absolutely can. The paper proves that these exact same physical ingredients can cause a flood in an entirely different synoptic setup.
Synoptic setup meaning a massive continent-spanning weather pattern rather than a localized storm.
Exactly.
The Alaskan Mountain Machine. We are looking at October 1986, the Kenai Peninsula, just south of Anchorage.
Oh, this case is fascinating.
Over 450 millimeters, which is 17.5 inches of rain, fell in just 2 days. And it wasn't a convective thunderstorm. There was no buoyant instability at all.
No, this was a pure non-convective orographic event.
Orographic meaning forced by mountains.
Right. So let's look at our ingredients again. P equals R times D. We still need moisture, lift, efficiency, and duration.
Okay, check them off.
So a massive synoptic weather system moved in from the ocean, carrying air with double the normal October moisture content.
Okay, that satisfies our moisture requirement.
Then it pushed that highly saturated air at 15 to 30 meters per second directly into a 1,500 meter mountain range.
And that mountain range provides the lift. It's essentially an immovable 1,500 meter brick wall that intercepts the atmospheric conveyor belt and just forces the air straight up into the freezing altitude.
Precisely. The lift was mechanically forced by the rock rather than by hot air rising on its own.
Fascinating.
And because the entire synoptic system was moving incredibly slowly, those forceful winds persisted for a staggering 48 hours.
Wow. Which satisfies your duration.
Exactly. You have a moderate rainfall rate forced by the mountain sustained for an extreme duration equaling 17.5 inches of rain.
There is a brilliant scientific detail regarding this Alaska case that I want to pull from the paper regarding the specific moisture depletion. It really highlights how mathematically sound this framework is.
Oh, it's a remarkable piece of data.
Tell us about it.
Well, by the time that air mass was forced over the Kenai Mountains and descended toward the city of Anchorage on the other side, weather balloon soundings showed it had lost 7 millimeters of precipitable water.
Wow. It literally rained out a huge portion of its moisture payload as it was forced over the peaks.
Right.
It wrung out the atmospheric sponge over the first barrier.
It did. But because it started with double the normal moisture, even after losing that 7 millimeters of water, it still possessed enough vapor to trigger more heavy rain when it traveled further inland and hit the next mountain range to the north.
That is wild.
It perfectly illustrates how an ingredients-based framework allows you to track the physical reality of the atmosphere step by step, mountain by mountain. Yeah. You aren't guessing, you know. You are tracking the physics.
So bringing all of this together, flash floods aren't just random, unpredictable acts of an angry nature. They aren't meteorological magic.
Definitely not.
They are the strict mathematical and physical consequence of lift, moisture, precipitation efficiency, and duration, combined with the ground's physical willingness or stubborn unwillingness to absorb it all.
Yeah.
When you strip away the black box algorithms and analyze the core physics, you finally understand how the experts view the sky.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture of extreme weather, this ingredients-based framework isn't utilized just for flash floods.
It applies to other stuff, too.
Oh, absolutely. The authors stress that this methodology is how the best atmospheric scientists approach tornadoes, blizzards, freezing rain, virtually all hazardous weather.
Wow.
You don't just look for a radar pattern that happens to match a textbook from 20 years ago. You ask yourself, what are the precise physical ingredients required for this specific event to occur? And is the atmosphere actively assembling them right now?
Right.
Relying on physics and mechanics rather than simple pattern recognition is ultimately what saves lives when the weather does something entirely unprecedented.
It completely changes how you experience a rainstorm, which leaves you, the listener, with a thought to mull over today.
A little homework.
Exactly. The next time you see a dark summer storm stall over your neighborhood and it seems like it just won't leave, don't just look up at the clouds. Ask yourself what invisible boundary of rain-cooled air is acting as a ramp, continuously fueling new storms in that exact spot.
And wonder what the soil beneath your feet is doing with all that sudden water.
Because suddenly, that murky diagnostic landscape we talked about at the very beginning starts to look a lot more like a clean, readable X-ray. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep looking up, keep asking questions, and we'll see you next time.